Hello and welcome to another Trademark Podcast, podcast number 105. I'm your host. Well, not really your host today. I'm introducing this podcast. My name's Stefan van Oerlein. And we recently had an event on the island of Inishere off the coast of Ireland in the Connemara Gaeltacht called Scoil Chuiscle, which means hedge school. You can look that up. It was a political education event with 150 activists from across Ireland and internationally. Some of the talks of that festival will be appearing across the Left Bloc platform of podcasts on the Left Bloc YouTube and also on like Insta and TikTok and other bits and bobs like that. This is the first of those talks, which kicked off the event, and it was an inspirational and indeed a tour de force by Claire Daly, ably introduced by Trademark's Dr. Maeve McDade. And here in this pod, Claire talks about why the EU's increased militarisation should really worry us all. Ever since the EU launched its own permanent structured cooperation on defence, or PESCO, it's been coordinating arms reduction and purchasing and driving militarisation across the region and giving substance to the Lisbon Treaty's provisions for a common foreign and defence policy. The speed of the process by which countries signed up to this, particularly countries outside of NATO that signed up to this pact, including Ireland, of course, was a red flag to any of us watching. In the face of what we can only describe as the multiple crises of capitalism and indeed the EU's own legitimacy crisis, PESCO is... it's kind of the European Union's ruling, or the European kind of ruling class's short-sighted attempt to create a cohesive imperialist bloc endowed with what would be credible military power. But perhaps more than that, it's testimony of the EU's own fragility and indeed the fragility of the capitalist system globally. But look, that's enough from me. Listen to the main act, listen to Claire Daly. Enjoy yourselves. Buenos saltas.
One of my few Irish words. Cúnas gurb míle maith agat maith agus Left Bloc tá anna áthas orm a bhí an seo. I have to say it's 42 years since I was here on Inishere for the Gaeltacht, and the last few words you've just heard are about all of the words that I can remember. I'm still kind of trying to adjust from that experience. But look at Máisiv Go Léir. This is an incredibly important event, an incredibly important topic, and I'm very honoured to be here to kick it off. Now, there's a view that's very popular in the European Union at the moment that the war in Europe, that the reason why we have war in Europe again, and let's remember it's not the first war since World War II, NATO after all did bomb Yugoslavia, but it's certainly the most serious war that we've had in Europe since World War II. And some people think that's because we've had too much militarism, but because we haven't had enough. Basically, it's our weakness that has facilitated Russian aggression. And the only way we're ever going to be safe again is to understand that the Russians are everywhere. They're coming to get us. And unless we spend potloads of cash, well, then really we're all doomed. Now, that's the narrative that's out there. It's unquestioned. It's repeated all across the board by the media, the political establishment. And of course, the only problem is that it's not true. Because the war in Ukraine has happened precisely against the backdrop of an unprecedented militarization in the European Union. It has been steadily and consistently rising since the signing of the Lisbon Treaty. We had the bringing into being of the European Defence Fund in the recent budget, the first time there was direct military expenditure from a European budget. Never supposed to happen. It has happened, and all in place before the war in Ukraine. All the difference the war in Ukraine has made is to put that policy on steroids. Because now what we have is every committee, every file, every initiative, whether it be on health, on education, on transport, all of them start with Russia's unprovoked war of aggression in Ukraine. It's repeated so often that you can kind of guess, you know what, that must have been provoked. And of course it was. It wasn't justified. Russia had no right to invade a sovereign country. It was illegal, but it certainly was provoked. And unless we understand that about the war, then we really cannot have a solution to it. Because the backdrop to the war was the continued expansion of NATO since the end of the Soviet Union, despite the promises that were made that that would not happen. 14 countries joined up, getting closer and closer to Russia's border. Every time they got nearer, every single Russian president said, this is making us nervous, lads. This is a threat to our security. Could you consider backing off a bit? And yet they got nearer and nearer. Even US senior military officials warned that Ukraine would be, understandably, a red line for Russia. Bit like the Bay of Pigs were for the Americans. But yet they persisted. In 2008, Bush said that Ukraine and Georgia were going to join NATO right on Russia's doorstep. 2014, they orchestrated and initiated a coup in Ukraine. So I think it's really important that we start by saying the war and the horrible war that we have now is a consequence of a conscious policy by NATO to encircle and goad Russia. And unfortunately, Putin's invasion gave them exactly what they wanted. We now have a situation where NATO has been rescued from obscurity. There had been a belief, actually, after Brexit, that once the Brits were gone, them being one of the biggest defenders of NATO, that that would give an impetus to the idea of an EU army. But actually what has happened is that the only show in town is NATO. You'll have seen Sweden and Finland joining, supposedly neutral countries, but they weren't really, let's be honest about it. But even so-called neutral Ireland, you've paid from your taxes to have NATO's headquarters in Brussels decorated recently, whether you know that or not. And the point, therefore, is when you hear Irish politicians talking about, I know there's not going to be an EU army, there is, or we're not going to join NATO, we will. They're kind of red herrings, because the real argument and the real process that's unfolding is that military integration in Europe is developing like never before, and Ireland is lap smack in the middle of it. And there's an irony out of the situation, because the war in Ukraine has seen kind of two opposite trends going on here. On the one hand, we see Europe very much now behaving as a vassal state of the US, prepared to jeopardize its own economic interests and well-being for a US-NATO proxy war against Russia. At the same time, you have European officials talking now about how they have to be independent. We have to be up to be part of the geopolitical game. High representative, what a ridiculous term, basically the Minister for Foreign Affairs of the European Union, Joseph Borrell, has recently said the concept of a geopolitical Europe is no longer an empty slogan, but a concrete reality. He goes on, EU capacity has to be developed if we really want to be an actor that's capable of wielding influence on what happens in the world using instruments of coercion. Do we? Seemingly we do. That is to say, making others behave the way we want them to behave. That's hard power. We must have hard power. On the one hand, you could say, simmer down a bit, Rambo. But on the other, you step back and you kind of say, well, actually, do you know what? These people are not normally that honest and that plain about what's going on. Because like all warmongers, they dress up their game in noble slogans. There's nothing new about that. The First World War, let's not forget, was the war to end all wars, except it wasn't. And after the bloodbath, everybody understood that this was insanity. They understood that it was the preparation by the great powers for war that above all else made war happen. Preparation for war results in war. And unfortunately, now we have a situation where that same insanity has taken hold over European political institutions again. Now we are in the middle of a new arms race. Military spending is breaking records every year. Yesterday in the European Parliament, we had Stoltenberg, the head of NATO, in, and he was bragging about the fact that it's at the highest level since the Cold War. 13% increase in the last year. But that's okay, because we're the good guys and we're fighting for peace, so nobody should be too worried about that. We have policies being produced by the European Union, glossy covers with pictures of doves and peace and security and all that good stuff. And all throughout it, they tell us that we have to change our understanding of what peace traditionally means. Traditionally, it meant peace. But now, actually, it means sending war and munitions into a war zone. It means, and they tell us that it means that the EU is now being called upon. They don't tell us by who, maybe God, maybe someone else, we don't know. But the EU is being called upon to realize its potential as an actor in defense of peace. And the last word, of course, goes to Ursula von der Leyen, she of the perfect hair, who will tell you that, I don't know how she does it, frankly, but and I'm not really sure I want it, but in any case, she tells us that Europe has gained its power through peace, and peace through power. And you expect the sort of Hollywood B titles to come up after her. But look, at throughout all of that nonsense and that doublespeak, we see the pause of the military-industrial complex. Because over 10 years ago, there was a discussion in the European Union, how are we going to make Europe safe? So they said, I know, we'll pull together a group of experts to tell us how we might do that. Now, they called it the group of personalities. I'm not really sure why that was. It wasn't famous actors or anything like that. Actually, the majority of them were arms companies that were the majority. And you'd be very surprised to realise that they came out with a finding that said, to be safe, we have to spend more money on arms. Duh, as if they would come up with anything else. So that's what we got. We got the European Defence Fund, which hands out grants to arms manufacturers. They make new systems. They develop research on new systems and technology. They get to keep the patent, and then they sell back the work that they developed on our money back to our countries to pay for it. Now, they call for proposals every year, and in the last year, they spent 832 million on 41 military programs. And surprise, surprise, the personalities were the biggest beneficiaries of the contracts. And of course, the European Defence Fund was up and running well before the war in Ukraine, but now it's gone absolutely off the Richter scale. Commissioner Breton tells us that, believe it or not, we are now in a war economy. Not a war on poverty, on homelessness, on climate change, or all of the real emergencies that are dogging the lives of ordinary people. No, no, no. Our war is on our shortage in defence procurement. We're just not at the races. It's a real emergency, and we have to get our act together. So the lads have a plan for that. Actually, they've four plans to ramp up defence expenditure. And I don't want to bore you on it, but at the same time, you are here to learn, and it is pretty shocking. So I'm going to have to spend a bit of time on some of these. Now, these are new programmes apart from the European Defence Fund, which I already talked about, and which is already costing you $8 billion a year. So first one out of the blocks is the Act in Support of Ammunition Production, or called ASAP. Conveniently, and as soon as possible, actually in record time for any European legislation, this has been rushed through. Now, how did they manage that? Well, it's to support the Ukraine, so why not? What do you need to say? Support Ukraine and the money will come. 500 million out of a rainy day fund, which was supposed to be there for unforeseen circumstances, to go and develop ammunition to be sent to Ukraine. Now, they were also looking as part of that in getting rid of the working time directive in the arms factories. So working class people in Europe could lose all their rights to go for weapons to kill working class people in Ukraine or in Russia. You couldn't make this stuff up. But 500 million of your money is going for ASAP. Now we have the second in line is the European Defence Industry Reinforcement Through Common Procurement Plan, which we're voting on in Strasbourg next week. This scheme basically just incentivizes countries to buy defence products. So if three countries get together to buy weapons, the European Money Union will give them their money back. It's a sort of a way of laundering money and pretending that the countries are buying it, but the EU taxpayer pays for it. Next one up is the Strategic Technologies for Europe platform, or STEP, as it's lovingly called. This is basically just a top-up to the European Defence Fund of another 1.5 billion. Now, I hope you're doing the sums, because we're not near done yet on this, and you're the ones who are paying for this. Because next up, we have the European Defence Investment Programme. That's the long game, where this procurement is going long into the future. And that's just the on-budget sums. And if you're thinking, well, look, that's not really that bad. Okay, It's a good bit of billions, but not that bad. Well, let's look at the rest of it then. Because first of all, you have the Orwellian titled European Peace Fund, which replaced the African Peace Fund, which sort of did stuff like capacity building and this kind of thing. This one now is the member states, including Ireland, give money to help external actions with a military implication. This means, sounds harmless, assistance to our partner countries in peacekeeping, which means sending lethal weapons into a war zone in the new European global speak. So we've had 500 million on that, another 1 billion to reimburse member states, another 1 billion in joint procurement, over 5 billion into that fund directly to Ukraine. The whole fund itself has been more than doubled to 12 billion. And if that wasn't bad enough, Borrell wants another fund for Ukraine, the defence fund for Ukraine, which they want by the end of the year, a whopping 20 billion or 5 billion a year for ammunition and missiles. And the best bit about it is it's going to continue indefinitely. Even if there's a peace agreement, even if there's a ceasefire, they envisage this coming along to deter Russia. Now, you couldn't make this stuff up. And you can see very clearly that the new Cold War has become pretty hot. Militarization isn't abstract. It's here, it's now, and we in Ireland are smack in the middle of it. So let's look at it a little bit more. Micheál Martin, our good friend, tells us that the triple lock, that's the mechanism for sending Irish troops abroad, or more than 12, is not fit for purpose. We need to modernise it, make it fit for purpose. But what purpose is it not fit for? The only purpose it's not fit for is sending troops on missions that haven't been sanctioned by the United Nations. And why in God's name would we want anything to do with that? Because they already have us involved in PESCO. You've heard of that a little bit more, not thanks to the government. We had to fight to get it known. We didn't have to join that, but we did. And it commits us to ramping up our military expenditure to 2% of GDP. We have the common security and defence missions. Now, these are mostly in Africa. Yikes. Nine military ones, 12 civilian ones. We in Ireland are already involved in training missions there that don't need the triple lock. And basically, member states send troops. France might send one to this one. France sends them to all of them, actually. Ireland might send one to that one. But these missions are under EU structures, under EU military headquarters, guided by EU strategies. Now, there was a bit of a confusion in the messaging recently, and a few of the lads in Africa got a bit confused. They didn't understand that we're there to further their interests, to bring them peace and to help them. And somehow or another, they think that Europe is there to further its own interests, to get critical raw materials and that shock horror. And seemingly, they don't want to put up with that anymore. Who could blame them? And why would Ireland want to be part of that? But the jewel in the crown has got to be the new development towards an EU army that isn't your EU army. And that is the rapid deployment capacity. Now, this is a permanently available, standing, multinational, modular EU force of initially 5,000 troops, including land, air, maritime components, funded from an EU budget, under the full command and control of a permanent EU headquarters, synchronised with, aligned with, and in the framework of NATO. These are all quotes, by the way. It's for collective defence, capable of rapidly deploying into future battlefields outside the Union to protect the Union's values and interests, including in non-permissive zones, which they made it clear is boots on the ground in countries that don't want you there. So when Micheál Martin says that there's no EU army, I don't know what you'd call a combat-ready standing force of 5,000 people, which is soon going to be 20,000, anything other than an army, that's what it is. And this is a giant con. It's a racket. These are the guys who break into your house and come back the next day and sell you an alarm. That's what this is all about. They cause the problems and then they put themselves forward as the solution. And all of it, and I don't have time to go into it, but we could talk about disinformation, hybrid threats, cyber threats. All of these are money-making rackets to make people feel vulnerable, to control them, and to make money. It's an obscenity. And it is revealed at its most brutal in terms of Ukraine, because the people of Ukraine are nothing more than a prop or a stage for these battles. We had Stoltenberg, as I said, in yesterday before the European Parliament, and he was waffling on about the amount of equipment that the EU had delivered to Ukraine. We support Ukraine. We stand with Ukraine. We're absolutely great. Now, the main thing is to get the signatures on the contracts. We need the contracts signed to get the production ramped up. We need the procurement ramped up. Not once did he mention the people who will be using those weapons, the people who are dying, the hundreds of thousands who are already dead or injured, the Ukrainian men who are being rounded up with disabilities, with mental health issues, the ones who can't get away, hiding in their houses, the students who've been locked in behind boundaries, not allowed to leave their countries to fight in a senseless war. And this morning, as we waited for the plane, I read in Euronews that there are Spanish companies recruiting people to go and fight for Ukraine for $3,400 a month if you make it into the elite division. So you pay 700 euros to get 5 days training. You're sent off to Ukraine. You can be in the front line for 3,400 euros. I don't know if you'll ever see any of that, because sadly, the rates of attrition of ordinary working people getting killed in this proxy war are really absolutely devastating. It's a quintessential proxy war. That's all that they are concerned about. And we can see the truth filtering into some of the newspapers in the current period. We saw articles in the Financial Times in the last month where they talk about the war in Ukraine now as being the first time NATO weaponry is being used on a large scale against the Russian army. And it's giving Western militaries invaluable insight into its performance. Kiev's Western allies, and this is actually a quote, it's so disgusting, can actually see if their weapons work, how efficiently they work, if they need to be upgraded. For military industries in the world, you can't invest in a better testing ground, says the Ukraine's Minister for Defence. I'm sure that's really comforting for the women, the children who lost husbands, sons, fathers, brothers in the slaughter. We also see the cynical comments about the counteroffensive, with some US officials bemoaning the fact that the Ukrainians have become casualty averse. They don't want people to be dying. They're not charging headfirst into the front lines of the minefields. What is wrong with these selfish wasters that they're not prepared to sacrifice themselves any longer? This is the mentality of these sick individuals who are running and making sure this show continues. We see cluster munitions. We are now talking about depleted uranium and the damage done for generations afterwards. How is this helping Ukraine? How does keeping a war going help anybody in Ukraine? With the loss of territory, the loss of lives, the refugees and so on. It is a meat grinder. War is never stopped by more war. It can only be stopped by peace. And you know, everything that's been done by the West, and articulated always by their mouthpieces in the media and across the political spectre, is to stymie peace and make sure it doesn't happen. And those of us who call for it, of course, are Putin puppets. We're not anti-war, we're just anti-Ukraine, you know. That could be the only logical explanation to our comments. It's absolutely ridiculous. Before this war, it was established wisdom and practice that you never send arms into a conflict zone. But now, of course, that's what you have to do. You have to stand up to the bully. Now, you don't have to stand up to the bully if you're in Yemen and you're fighting a war against the Saudis. You don't have to stand up to a bully if you're a Palestinian under constant pressure and illegal bombardment from the Israelis. And I didn't ever see them arguing about arming the IRA either in terms of running the Brits out of Ireland. Instead, ironically, and I think it's really ironic when you see the figures, they got behind a peace agreement. And they know that a peace agreement wasn't doing nothing. It took actually years of a lot of hard and diplomatic work. And I find it deeply ironic that the same people now who are arguing that Ukraine has to win back every single bit of its territory, including Crimea, where the people have repeatedly said they want to be part of Russia before any peace can be considered. These are the same people who laud the Northern Ireland peace agreement as an historic achievement, even though it's left 17% of Ireland under British rule. It's left hundreds of thousands of Irish people under an administration that they don't agree with, that doesn't represent them. But people aren't getting killed, and it put forward a roadmap for how issues like a united Ireland or minority rights might have been dealt with. And there was a plan for a peace plan for Ukraine on the table 2 months after the war started, that in return for Ukraine not joining NATO, Russia would pull back to the pre-February borders. A process was put forward over 10 and 15 years for how the Donbass and Crimea would be dealt with. It was the West that scuppered that. It was the West who told them to keep fighting. This is all about a US strategic interest against Russia and the profits of the military-industrial complex. So Russia are certainly responsible for invading Ukraine, and we condemn them for that. But NATO and the US and the EU are responsible for keeping it going. Now, these same individuals have stirred the pot against Ukraine. These are the ones who are trying to do the same in Taiwan. The delicate balance that has existed there for decades, stoking and provoking China. We have color revolutions. We have the funding of regime change operations around the world. You know the figure, 750 US military bases in 80 countries. The US has been at war for over 95% of its history. But you know what? NATO, that parasite, which is responsible for 3/4 of the global military expenditure, and the US at the heart of it, this is essentially a vehicle for promoting US interests in a post-war period, but it's about to learn a very valuable lesson. Be careful what you wish for, because they might have succeeded in having Europe castrate itself, have its economies in recession, pauperize the people with a cost of living crisis and an energy crisis, which they're bailing us out that we have to pay for to the tune of billions. But far from isolating Russia and establishing Western dominance, the war in Ukraine has actually revealed their weakness. We now have a new world order being born, and US hegemony has had its day. That doesn't mean it's easy or it's going to be quick or anything like that. As they say, the last bite of a dying snake is actually the most dangerous. So these are very dangerous times that we live in. But on the plus side, the countries where the majority of the world's population live have seen it through it. They've had enough. They're not prepared to be dominated by empire or the old colonial powers any longer. They refuse to be dragged in to the war in Ukraine. Not because they don't care about the people of Ukraine or because they're puppets of Russian disinformation. Because they've seen and they've been at the brunt of imperialist war on their continents and in their countries for many years. They understand the hypocrisy. And there's been a crusade by the West. We went to Pakistan in the last year. Pakistan is the fifth most populous country in the world. And the Minister for Foreign Affairs had just been back from a UN meeting. And she told us about how they'd been bullied and browbeaten by the US to try and get them to abstain in the vote or could vote to condemn Russia over the war in Ukraine. A fifth biggest populous country. And it was touch and go. Other countries gave in. They didn't. They held their ground. You'd have seen the extension of BRICS, the new alternative base around China. 46% of the world's countries, 3.7 billion people, a GDP of greater than $30 trillion, and 80% of oil production. So what we see actually is a new world order where multipolarity and international law have a chance for the first time in a long time because they've been seriously under attack. But now there is a chance. The stranglehold of the dollar, which has seen vicious, illegal sanctions imposed on people all over the globe. It's mass murder. in countries like Syria, in countries like Yemen, in Venezuela, in Cuba, and all of these areas through the use of sanctions. It's the dollar and the primacy of the dollar that has allowed them to do that. The New Deal around BRICS puts a chink in that because there's a new big guy in town and there's a possibility, and that should give us great hope. The stranglehold of French influence and the French currency in Africa similarly has seen its day. The young populations in Africa, 5-6 coups, each one developing after the next, trying to shake off the shackles of Western imperialism. They're sick of being colonized and being ruled. So what we see is the world being a much smaller place. And social media has played a little bit of that. We are constantly amazed by the amount of people who get in touch with us. I mean, if you read the Irish newspapers, you'll hear that myself and Mick Wallace, well, we're an embarrassment and a disgrace, standing out and talking about peace and against the war means we are just, it's just absolutely shocking for the people of Ireland. We don't represent the people of Ireland in that view. And yet every single day we get people contacting us from all over Europe saying, thank goodness that you're there. You're at least putting the alternative view. We went to Pakistan. We met somebody in the airport who said, ye the Irish politicians, we know you. We follow what you're doing. Last year, I got a text from a Fine Gael minister who was down in Rwanda at a meeting in Africa. And this fella said to him, do you know Claire Daly? We follow all her speeches over here. It was just fucking true. I wasn't going to say that because it makes me sound big-headed, and I don't mean it to sound like that, but it just shows the influence that that platform has had. It's absolutely amazing how many people around the world have followed the work that we do. It really is quite incredible. I remember one of my war speeches, my landlord in Belgium, her friend in Peru had sent her a video of one of my speeches in the European Parliament calling for peace, saying, look at this Irish politician not knowing that I was the tenant in their flat. So it is a very small world. And the reason why we've got such an echo is two reasons, one bad, one good. I suppose the bad one is that the darker the sky, the brighter the star. And maybe the sky is a bit dark, in that we look at this monolithic view in terms of the media and the political establishment, and it looks like they're all over here and everyone else is over there, and you're kind of going, Jesus, how will we ever break through this? But it does show that when that alternative view is put, then people absolutely cannot get enough of it, because it represents the hearts and minds of what people are at. And that, to me, shows the unique role that Ireland could play on the world stage. We know they have bastardised our neutrality over the year. They paid a nod and a wink of, ah, yeah, we're neutral, but Uncle Sam, bring in the lads. As long as you like, they can come in, hundreds of thousands of them every year on their way to theatres of war, but we pretend to be neutral. But that said, our neutrality remains in the hearts of Irish people, and Micheál Martin got to hear that when he tried his stupid consultation forums, and in fairness, Michael D, but a lot of the people saw through that nonsense and kind of indicated that they are not going willing to see that neutrality be pushed over or eliminated. So I think the reason why people are attached is that we are uniquely placed. We are a country in Western Europe that was formerly colonized ourselves. We are neutral, and we have that affinity that can be a bridge to people everywhere. And that was the card that we used to kind of market. People used to say, where are you from? Oh, are you from England? Are you from America? No, we're not. We're from Ireland. And people say, oh, we love the Irish, because Ireland had that unique experience in our bones. And I think we saw it re-emerging when Fianna Fáil moved to try and attack it. But they haven't gone away, you know, as the slogan goes. They are coming back for that. And even though the consultation forums were a bit of an embarrassment for Micheál, didn't go all his way, We all know, I'm not going to slag them off. You all know how bad they were. The dogs in the streets, no, they weren't a consultation forum. They were a total sham. A bunch of so-called experts sitting out there to give the right answer without any participation by real people at all. But that said, they will come back in the autumn with some attack, either on the triple lock. And even if they don't, they are already ingraining us hand over fist in military alliances and so on. So we need to understand that when we talk about fighting militarism here on this island, on the offshores of Galway, it's very much part of the world stage, because nobody in their right mind would spend the type of money that I outlined at the start on weapons of destruction to kill people, when there's people who don't have a roof over their head, people who are going hungry, a planet that's burning up. Who would have thought that we'd have weather like this in the Aran Islands? It's great now, but it's not natural. Nobody would stoke division or cause the problems that they face. You know, in fairness, most people's instinct is for cooperation. Our planet requires a cooperative response to deal with problems like climate change. So when the powers that be come for our neutrality in the autumn, or even another chip of it, we have to be ready for that. They waffle on about cyber attacks, about underwater cables. You know, HSC was attacked by Russian hackers. No, they weren't. They were a bunch of fellas, really, in their bedrooms. Yes, they probably did come from Russia, because a lot of these fellas do, but it wasn't the Russian state attacking the HSC programs. And if they had invested in a tiny, tiny, tiny bit of computer hardware and protection gear, they wouldn't have even been able to do it in the first place. This is a nonsense. They tell us that we are the center of the cables of the world. If you listen to me, Hall Martin, you'd think that every single cable passed through the coast where we are here. 98% of cables are underwater. Yeah, they are. But that's for the whole world. In Ireland, there's six of them. Six of them. And they all go in different directions. So if the Russians were to somehow decide to attack them all, well, then we'd have a much bigger problem, because we'd be in the middle of a pretty major war at that stage. So probably the cables would be the least of our worries. But all the cables are going in different directions. 20% of them get damaged every year anyway, not by Russian spies, but by fishermen, and the world doesn't stop. So it's actually not a big problem at all. And it's more a problem for Google. It's private infrastructure anyway, so they should be paying for it, not us spending feckin' going underwater with NATO and all the rest of it. Is it a con? This is a money-making racket from start to finish. And if you're not convinced and you're still worried about the cables and you think that that might be a reason for why we should join NATO, well, think about the only area where underground infrastructure did actually get blown up, as in Nord Stream 2, and that was in the middle of NATO heartland anyway, so it won't protect us if it comes to that anyway. It's a nonsense. And all I'll say, because you're as melting as I am, is that this is a racket. It's not about fighting for democracy. It's not about fighting for values, no matter where you are. The war machine and the military-industrial complex owns the president of the US. They own the leadership of the European Union. And they wage their wars for their own corporate interests and geopolitical dominance. And for us, the only war that counts, the real war that's behind it all, is the class war. For us to exert pressure and take back what's ours from these absolute lunatics who want to kill and see people die for the profits of a tiny minority. It's lunacy in this day and age when the world needs cooperation. So the main thing ye need to do this weekend, and all of us need to do, is pay attention to truth, to learn the lessons of history, to educate ourselves, to remind ourselves of the words of Julian Assange and of him currently in incarceration continuously now, but that if wars can be started by lies, peace can be started by the truth. So you're here for a weekend mission of truth learning. So learn the truth, do your homework, enjoy the weekend, and go out from here determined to defend our neutrality as our part in the global war against militarism. Thank you so much.